Blog Talk Radio. Okay, hello and welcome to the November 6, 2011 edition of Don't Let It Go Unheard. It's the podcast devoted to discussion of news and politics from the perspective of Ayn Rand's philosophy, objectivism. I'm your host, Amy Peikoff, and here are the topics I have planned today. It's our second time appearing on Blog Talk Radio, and this is why you had that long silence just now. Sorry about this, everyone. We're trying to get used to this interface here. I assume you can hear us now. Go ahead and type in the chat if you can. Anybody? I see David and Nolan are in the chat. A bunch of other people. Anyone? Now I'm not so sure if people can hear us. Anyone type in the chat? Let me go ahead and type in the chat and see if you can hear us. Oh, excellent. Okay, good, good. People can hear me. Excellent. Okay, so here are our topics. First, we have the International Atomic Energy Agency expected to release a new report this week detailing the progress Iran is making in its quest to develop nuclear weapons. Might Israel or the United States strike Iran to prevent this? Not if Ron Paul has anything to say about it. So we'll talk about that. Second, we've heard all about the legal challenge to the Patient Protection Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare. And those challenges were based on limitations to congressional power under the Commerce Clause. Today we'll talk about a similar sort of challenge, but this time based on the Constitution's Spending Clause. Third, what in the world is happening in Greece? And how does the reality of the situation stack up against the Saturday Night Live parody of it? And then I also want to talk a little bit about former Governor Jesse Ventura's lawsuit against the TSA. It was dismissed this week for lack of jurisdiction. And we're wondering, are there any merits to his public characterizations of the U.S. government as fascist based on the policies that led to this dismissal? And we've got some more if there's time. Before we dive in here, some logistics. There's two ways for those of you who are attending live to interact with me. You can call in. The phone number is 760-888-5817. Again, that's 760-888-5817. Or you can type some comments here in the chat room. And let's go ahead and dive in. As I said, this week, the International Atomic Energy Agency is expected to release a report on Iran's nuclear activities. And as is the case with so much of this stuff, there have been some leaks already to the media. There's some diplomatic sources in Vienna, I guess, who have leaked some of the content of this forthcoming report. It says that according to these leaks, and I'm looking at a story from Haaretz.com, that's Haaretz.com, according to some leaks, Iran has carried out experiments in the final critical stage for developing nuclear weapons. This includes explosions and computer simulations of explosions. The Associated Press and other media outlets have reported that satellite photos of a site at a place called Parchin Military Base, which is 30 kilometers from Iran, satellite photos of that site have revealed a bus-sized container for conducting experiments. And sources say that this time around, you know, 8 years ago, I guess they suspected this, but Parchin did not allow a visit to the IAEA to go ahead and look at the base. The IAEA rules apparently permit the member states, such as Iran, to deny visits to military bases. So 8 years later, they are again suspecting that this is a location for covert military nuclear activity. And apparently this time around, the report is going to contain clearer language on the military aspects of the Iranian nuclear program. And they're saying, though, that the report is in its final drafting stages. And for the report to be released with all of these clearer details, it's going to have the approval of the Director General of the IAEA, who is Yukiya Amano. So, yes, politics is going to dictate what is actually released in the report. The report is supposed to also include a 12-page appendix, and that appendix will have details including documents and satellite photos to support the contention that, in violation of its international obligations, Iran is covertly developing nuclear weapons. I don't know that this is much of a surprise to any of us, right? Now, diplomats are saying that it's unlikely that the IAEA's governing board is going to condemn Iran when it meets on November 17th and 18th. It says it might take months to convince China and Russia to support a board resolution that could be the first step towards additional UN sanctions. So again, more politics. And of course, the sanctions have been so effective up to this point in preventing Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. So then the question is, and this has been kind of floated around in different articles this week, more in articles that are available abroad than here, is Israel or United States even planning some sort of an attack on these Iranian sites? And it's not just at this Parchin military base. There's also apparently a site at QLM. Yeah. And another site within Iran where they are developing these nuclear weapons. So the question is, are they going to do something about it? U.S. officials visited Israel in October, and Israel refused to commit to withhold a surprise attack on Iran. Apparently, Leon Panetta went to visit and talk to Benjamin Netanyahu and also Defense Minister Ehud Barak, that Israel, and they said that they would not take action against nuclear facilities without coordinating any such operation with the United States. This is what Panetta wanted. Panetta wanted them to commit that they would not take this action on their own. They would coordinate it with us. And surprise, surprise, Israel said, no, we're not going to commit to that. And apparently Israel had been fairly silent in recent months about what it might do. And so United States got a little bit worried and wanted to go and have a meeting with them. Panetta apparently held a little press conference. He hinted that we oppose an Israeli assault on Iran. He said that countries must work together to assure that Iran did not pose a threat to the region, and added that a solution to the Iranian nuclear issue requires the coordination of the international community. And then the article on Haaretzer that I'm looking at speculates two different things as to what this could mean. They say the defense secretary's visit could mean, on the one hand, that planning is indeed taking place for Israeli military action in Iran, and that they don't plan to coordinate their operation with us. So that's one thing it could mean. And then the other thing it could mean, though, is that perhaps what Israel is trying to do is apply pressure on the United States so that we step in and do something about Iran. But in any event, Israel has not committed as to whether it's going to do anything at all. What does Ron Paul want done about this? Bosch was taking a look at the news today and got an earful about that. What's going on with that?
Well, he was on Fox News, I guess, and someone asked him what he would do to deter Iran from getting nukes, and he said, we should offer them friendship. This is not a joke. It's not The Onion. And I made a cartoon about it. Of course, that's my fourth or fifth cartoon of Ron Paul. Basically, he wants to be friends with a country that has declared war on us for the last 30 years. American blood on its hands. Has killed Americans in Iraq through proxy terrorist groups and whatnot, and he wants to be friends with them. So,
I mean, you know, I've been looking at different news sources, and I'm about to tell you what I found in a story from The Guardian UK. Actually, I found some stories at Guardian UK via Drudge. So Drudge sometimes does link to some good news sources. Sometimes he also links to that guy. What's InfoWars or something?
The guy who basically Ron Paul goes on, the Alex Jones.
Yeah.
Who's,
so,
you know,
obviously Drudge doesn't always link to good news sources, but in this case I found some good Guardian UK stories. And when I went there looking for some more, I found a story that said that Friday, I believe, was the 32nd anniversary of Iran taking hostages, United States
where
hostages.
Where they declared war on us 32 years ago.
And they are celebrating it today, having their usual death to America.
Yeah,
in the
death
streets,
to America,
right?
Death to America, let's be friends.
And then in the meantime, Ron Paul is on Fox News saying that the answer is we just have to offer them friendship. Now, didn't Barack Obama have this stupid thing that he said?
For their
holiday. But he said to them when he became president, he says, if you will unclench your fist, we will. What was this?
If you unclench your fist, we will. I forgot.
Like, offer our hand in friendship.
Something
or he wanted to be friends.
Their fist is around our throat. I mean, yeah.
Yeah. Michael here says Ron Paul's foreign policy equals friendship at any price. I mean, here's the thing. So he's calling for more appeasement.
Yeah.
And we have this week here, we don't even have to look at overseas news sources. We have in Oakland, in the Occupy Wall Street movement, an example of what appeasement gets you in practice, in reality. Many of you have probably already heard this story. There's a men's warehouse in Oakland that decided that it would go ahead and demonstrate its sympathy with the Occupy movement in Oakland, the Occupy Oakland movement. They shut down their store for an entire day, right, Bosch?
Yep, they did, for a Wednesday to be in solidarity with the occupiers.
Yeah.
A business to be in solidarity with anti-business.
And then, of course, what happened?
They smashed their windows.
Yeah, the Occupy people went ahead and smashed the windows at Men's Warehouse. So that's exactly what appeasement gets you. And, you know, it's been shown not even, you know, just to not help you, but to hurt you time and time and time again. And this is one of the reasons that, you know, we were worried. We were talking last week about Gilad Shalit, the deal that they made to get him free.
1,000 cutthroat murderers.
Yeah, they free 1,000 murderers for one hostage, an Israeli soldier. It's not that I want an Israeli soldier to die or be left over there to rot in their jail or whatever.
But more Israelis are guaranteed to be murdered now. Guaranteed.
I just don't think this appeasement works.
Last week, I called the occupiers the P party, not T, P party. And this week, I call them the V party for violence. So,
yeah, because
it's unbelievable how violent they're burning. They're
setting fires and all that.
10 cops were injured.
If you watch the videos, and then in Oakland, isn't that right?
Oakland, yeah.
Yeah, this is Oakland.
That's
right. It's the mayor there who is also
mayor's encouraging them.
Not
deliberately to hurt people, but they're saying, you know, we stand with you, the mayor.
And the mayor is supposed to also be behind the police who are getting hurt in the process of some of this stuff too. So it's really a sad thing. And this shows, I mean, this just shows what appeasement gets you. And I don't know what Ron Paul is thinking here.
He's not thinking. He really doesn't think.
Gary Johnson also says, it's going to be 10 years before Iran actually gets
me. He's a military expert, right? I mean, he's a military expert.
Well, I mean,
Gary Johnson.
He should
say. Don Johnson. Gon Johnson.
I mean, there's a couple things to think here. I mean, this is why we don't want Ron Paul as president, right? 10 years, first of all, even if it is 10 years, 10 years is not that long.
No.
It's shorter than you think. You'll turn around tomorrow and in 10 years.
Meaning what,
we'll
though? Meaning in the meantime, we'll wait till 10 years and then, okay, now we'll do something about it when they get nukes.
Yeah.
You know what? Because, I mean, we've been treating them as if they have nukes.
Yeah.
And when they get nukes, what will we do?
I don't know. And then the second thing is that I bet it's actually going to be sooner. Right?
Of course, yeah.
You know, I don't know where they get these estimates if it's going to take 10 years. If it,
the
you know,
IA,
they can't
EA,
see exactly what they're doing. Yeah.
You know, the IAEA had a guy named Mohammed Al-Baradei there for 10 years. I think they hired him because of his first name. I'm not joking. It might as well be called the Islamic,
So now we get to see, is there going to be anything done other than trying to be their friend? And as a matter of fact, there might be. And I saw this story earlier this week, and as I said, it's from The Guardian UK. The Guardian UK is a great source for news information. We get much better, more complete news coverage from The Guardian UK than we do here in the United States. And it started to make me think, if some of you are familiar with Pat Condell, I love Pat Condell's videos, but someone like Pat Condell can exist in England and have such good positions on foreign policy issues in particular, even though he's not an objectivist. As far as I know, I don't think he's an objectivist at all.
He's an atheist, and he's very rational about this.
Yeah, and I think it's just because he is actually confronted with facts, with detailed facts all the time. He was also good on riots in London, so it wasn't just foreign policy.
No, he's very good. And he's very angry, too. He's like the best kind of comedians there, where they're outraged. They're like, you know, really frustrated idealists.
Yeah. So it makes me think, go to the Guardian UK. Yes, I get some of the stories via Drudge, but why not just go there directly and skip all that Alex Jones InfoWars conspiracy?
I can't believe he, you know, linked him.
So here's the story. The story is UK military steps up plans for Iran attack amid fresh nuclear fears. And yeah, Drudge passed this along this week. British officials are under contingency options to back up a possible United States action against Iran, it says. So it says the British Armed Forces, they're stepping up their contingency planning for potential military action against Iran amid mounting concern about Tehran's nuclear enrichment program. Ministry of Defense believes that the U.S. may decide to fast forward plans for targeted missile strikes at some key Iranian facilities. British officials say that if Washington presses ahead, it will seek and receive UK military help for any mission, despite that there are some reservations within the coalition government. And they're not talking years. They're talking within the coming months. That's the time frame that they're talking about here. Now, of course, they all say that Barack Obama has no wish to embark on a new and provocative military venture before next November's presidential election. Okay. Now, I say to that, that's BS, because he would do it just to get reelected, I think.
Absolutely. He'd do it October 2012.
Yeah. But they said that they warned that the calculations could change because of mounting anxiety over intelligence gathered by Western agencies and the more belligerent posture that Iran appears to be taking. And throughout this article, they are expressing just puzzlement about the fact that Iran is taking this more belligerent posture. They had all these demonstrations on Friday. There was the 32nd anniversary of the hostage crisis, the usual death to America stuff. So it says here in the article that hawks in the United States are likely to seize on next week's report from the International Atomic Energy Agency, which is expected to provide fresh evidence of a possible nuclear weapons program in Iran. This bulletin, they say, could be a game changer. And that Iran is surprisingly resilient in the face of sanctions. Iran appears to be newly aggressive, and we are not and we are not quite sure why. This is sort of like, you know, Ayn Rand is getting popular again, right?
Yeah. No, but
Iran is nuclear is newly
all
aggressive.
Been aggressive. Yeah. 30 years. That's how they were, you know.
Yeah.
What
they're citing in particular, though, are these three recent assassination plots on foreign soil that the intelligence agencies are saying were coordinated by elements in Tehran. Now, why? Could it be appeasement? Could it be that they are emboldened by the new Islamic governments coming into power elsewhere in the Middle East?
I'd say. And they want to be in charge.
Yeah, they want to be the ones in charge. They want to take control. And, of course, if there is unrest within their countries, if they can focus everyone on the so-called common enemy, which is the great Satan, United States, or, you know, much easier common enemy to do is Israel, then, you know, that would be the good thing, too. Now, they said that, you know, there was that Stuxnet computer worm last year that was thought to have been engineered by Americans and Israelis, and it had many of the centrifuges that they were using to enrich uranium. But now it appears that all the capacity has been recovered and perhaps is even increasing. So they're worried about that. And they're also concerned because the Iranians, and this is all from the Guardian UK article. We don't get this in the United States, right?
Yeah.
Says the Iranians have been moving some more efficient centrifuges into the heavily fortified military base dug beneath a mountain near the city of Qom. Says the concern is that the centrifuges, which can be used to enrich uranium for use in the weapons, are now so well protected within the site that missile strikes may not be able to reach them. The senior Whitehall source said that Iranians appeared to be shielding material and capability inside the base. Another official with knowledge of Britain's military planning said that within the next 12 months, Iran may have hidden all the material it needs to continue a covert weapons program inside fortified bunkers. He said this had necessitated the UK's planning being taken to a new level. And he says, beyond 12 months, we couldn't be sure our missiles could reach them, end quote, the source said. He says, quote, so the window is closing and the UK needs to do some sensible forward planning. The US could do this on their own, but they won't. so we need to anticipate being asked to contribute. We had thought this would wait until after the U.S. election next year, but now we are not so sure. And, you know, they're saying President Obama doesn't want to do anything just before an election. But again, I don't see why that would stop him. It hasn't stopped him yet with regard to Gaddafi or anybody else. Yeah. So it looks like, and again, the rest of this article, what it does is it just kind of gives details about what they might do. They're talking about both missiles. There's no plans for a ground invasion, but a small number of special forces may be needed on the ground. So this is a lot of details for something that supposedly isn't going to happen in a 10-year time frame. Skipping further down the article, and again, this is an article from Guardian UK, Wednesday, November 2nd. UK military steps up plans for Iran attack amid fresh nuclear fears. Further down the article, it says it's estimated that Iran, which has consistently said it is interested only in developing a civilian nuclear energy program.
Peaceful nukes.
Yeah, peaceful. Already has enough enriched uranium for between 2 and 4 nuclear weapons. Experts believe it could be another 2 years before Tehran has a ballistic missile delivery system. So this is a lot shorter than any of this weird 10-year time frame that everybody always talks about.
And they're going to wait for them to get them?
Now, in the meantime, it says the U.S. is considering sending more naval warships into the area soon. We're building up our military presence there. And it says we are seeking to expand military ties with the 6 countries in the Gulf Cooperation Council, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Bahrain, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, and Oman, which a lot of good that's going to do us. It's much better just sticking with England. So it might happen a lot sooner rather than later. I've got a call here, so I'm going to go ahead and invite you to speak with me. Hello, you're on the air. Hello? Oh, I don't hear anybody there. I don't know what that sound was.
I don't know.
Okay, well, if you are on and you want to type in the chat that you're there ready to talk, then go ahead and let me know. I've got some comments here on the talk.
I can't number them. You got to number them. You got to go up.
No, I don't have any more.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, we have one call for right now.
Comments.
Oh, comments. Yeah, we have a lot of comments for sure. A lot of people like to talk on the chat and not call in. Call in, people. Let me give you the number again here. 760-888-5817. And let me get through some of these, some of the comments here.
One second. Someone says, hold on.
Which one? Which one are you looking
at? A little
at? Lower. This is as low as it goes.
Okay, go a little higher then.
Okay.
Someone said that he's as bad as Obama when it comes to foreign policy. I'd argue that he makes Obama look like a hawk. Ron Paul.
Well, Ron,
no joke.
Ron Paul would never have done the Libya. Of course, I would never have done the
Libya operation
either.
Obama, you know, he's not, he didn't do it for our self-interest. No, but what I'm saying is Ron Paul wants to be friends with the terrorist country.
I like Michael's imaginary dialogue here. He says, Ron Paul says, can't we all just get along? And the Islamic world says, no, we want you to die. And Ron Paul says, aw, shucks, now you're just fooling, right? Let's be friends. I don't know what it would take to convince him. I really don't. But, of course, he believes
nothing.
That we're to blame for 9/11.
Yeah, everything. Because we were there. What does that mean? Yeah. And they weren't here?
Now, Alexander here says the State Department says that every year Iran is the world's most active state sponsor of terror.
And for this,
so this new business is a joke. Yeah,
State Department to concede that. I mean, that's unbelievable. They're anti-American.
Yeah, the idea that
they're for every state besides ours.
That they're new, you know, they're newly belligerent. Now,
that's incredible.
Whether this is peaceful nuclear energy, apparently the report this week is going to supposedly give us a lot of details to say it's definitely not a peaceful nuclear program.
They're the greatest state sponsor of terrorism on Earth.
Why they have to go through a political process to release facts to us, I'm not exactly sure. So if you are indeed the caller who called me there and you are on hold and you do want to talk, let me know because we tried to unmute you and it didn't work.
Yeah, come on, guys, call in.
Yeah, but in terms of Pat Condell, I do recommend that you look at the video. It's called Useful Idiots for Palestine, and that's Pat Condell on YouTube. It's as all one word with 2 L's at the end, Pat Condell. Definitely recommend checking that out. Apropos of that, I saw a story today that says that anti-Semitic attitudes are on the rise in the United States, and that's not surprising. Useful Idiots for Palestine, as I said, is the title of the video by Pat Condell, and he is talking about the fact that if you are in support of the so-called Palestinians, then you are supporting anti-Semitism. That's,
you are supporting the butchering of Jews as well.
Yeah, that's the gist of the video here.
They even have queers for Palestine, so homosexuals for Palestine. Homosexuals for those who would kill homosexuals.
Yeah, and that's what they would do. I mean, they would hang them if they get the chance. MyFoxNews.com, it's MyFoxNY, so I guess it's MyFoxNewYork.com. This is a story from Friday, November 4th. It says, swastikas were found painted on the facades of the Jackson Heights and East Elmhurst branches of the Queens Library and on the door of Congregation Tifereth Israel on Thursday. The Anti-Defamation League today condemned the anti-Semitic graffiti. The ADL says there were 133 anti-Jewish incidents reported across New York City in 2010. A nationwide ADL survey released just yesterday found that anti-Semitic attitudes have risen in America. It found that 15% of Americans, 15%, nearly 35 million adults, hold deeply anti-Semitic views. They said that's up 3% from 2009. So this idea that as the country, you know, goes on, as the years go on, that people are less and less racist and everything else, I guess it's just completely wrong. 3% from 2009. So in 2 years, it's increased. It says the fact that anti-Semitic attitudes have increased significantly over the past 2 years is troubling and raises questions about the impact of broader trends in America, financial insecurity, social uncertainty, the decline in civility, and the growth of polarization on attitudes towards Jews, end quote. That was Abraham H. Foxman. He's the ADL National Director.
Well, you know, we also have a president who is not a friend of Israel.
Yeah.
That clearly helps.
Yeah. And I think, you know, this idea, a lot of people think, oh, there's no real reason to support Israel. No one ever talks about the case for supporting Israel, the positive case for supporting Israel. At best, our politicians seem to just say, well, we take it for granted that we support Israel. Right. And then a lot of people in the country who don't know any history and don't know the, you know, what Israel is in relation to its neighbors in the Middle East, they think, well, why are we expending all these resources? Right. Why don't we just let them go after Israel? What's Israel to us?
The politicians, by saying in verbal support, they think that's enough. That's
and they don't give the reason why. You know, that Israel.
Some of them give religious reasons. You know, some of them give religious reasons because it's a holy land. You know,
right. Some sort of non-essential
pathetic reason.
But the fact that Israel is the rights-respecting nation with respect to any of its neighbors there in the Middle East. No, it's not perfect, right? But as Pat Condell said in his video, I was watching it today, Arabs who live in Israel have more rights than Arabs who live in all the other countries.
Yeah.
And I believe it was Libya where the provisional government just announced that they are going to be governing according to Sharia. If you're a woman, an Arab woman who lives in, you know, Libya, what is your life like right now? I have no idea. So here, going back to this story about anti-Semitism in the United States, 19% answered probably true to the following statement. Jews have too much control/influence on Wall Street, end quote. So if you were asked if whether you agreed, they said that was probably true. That was an increase from 14%. In 2009. And of course, several cases of anti-Semitism have been documented at various Occupy Wall Street locations across the country. The survey also says among the African population has remained steady, but they're consistently higher than the general population. And in 2011, 29% of African Americans expressed strongly anti-Semitic views, according to the survey. I hadn't really realized that the numbers were that high. But if you think, I mean, if that means if I meet someone, I mean, this is statistics, obviously, and statistics, you know, it's a generalization. People are individuals. But one in three have strongly anti-Semitic views. That is really disturbing. It's very scary. If you think that just last century, right, almost halfway through the century,
yeah.
we discovered a horrible Holocaust in Germany, millions of Jews murdered because of anti-Semitism,
and
that this
that
attitude
they,
would still exist at
and
this
also,
rate.
And also, if there was a new Holocaust, would these people be, you know, against it necessarily?
No. Now, here's Dan here says, in Britain, the BBC is outrageous. He says it receives government funds in exchange for being unbiased,
yeah.
and it is consistently anti-Israel.
And pro-Islamic, to the point where some of their speakers, or they say, Muhammad, peace be upon him. They actually say that after they say the prophet's name. It's unbelievable. Peace be upon him.
Richard here says, people I speak with on a tech discussion forum I frequent are shockingly anti-Israel. Yeah, Dan says that in Britain, everybody just swallows what the BBC says.
It's the given, yeah.
Now, the one thing I was going to say about The Guardian UK, I was just glancing around different... Dan, I could ask what your opinion is of Guardian UK, if you're familiar with the different sources, the British media news sources. But I didn't think that they were necessarily always on the side that I agreed with. I just thought I was getting a lot more information. I saw a lot of editorials that said, oh, we really shouldn't get involved. Why do we have to defend Israel? That The Guardian UK was publishing. So it's not like that they are pro-Israel, The Guardian UK, but it's just you're actually getting the information.
They report it.
I felt like there was just so much more than we get here. Even The Wall Street Journal.
Wall Street Journal, the opinions could be terrible.
Definitely. So Dan says it's a commie crapsheet. Okay. Well, it could be a commie crapsheet, but I got a lot of good information from the commie crapsheet. Alexander here says Hitchens once commented on this by pointing out that the BBC commentators purposely mispronounce names like Wolfowitz to make sure everyone knew he was Jewish.
Well, people, you know, when it comes to anti-Semitism, about my own work, they say Faustein. You know, they try to, you know, accuse me, quote unquote, of being Jewish, because only Jews would be anti-jihad. I mean, that's it.
Okay. Now, I still have this person supposedly on hold. I'm going to try to see if I can unmute again. Hi, you're on the air, if you can hear me.
No.
Hello, are you there?
No.
Okay. I don't know why this person is called.
That's fine.
Doesn't want to speak. So, in terms of this, I mean, Pat Condell is right on the money. I was surprised, though, that we were actually thinking of a military operation. Had you had any inkling
of
that?
No, but I don't know. Is it true? Who are you talking to?
Would you believe that Obama would do it?
No, I wouldn't. Now, only again for re-election. Period.
Yeah.
That's it.
I mean, what if he could get us involved in a messy war with Iran?
It doesn't have to be messy. That's the problem, you know? None of these wars had to be messy. If he actually goes there and just takes out the bad guy and says, look, some quote-unquote collateral damage, it is what it is. Let's knock this major threat out and say, that's it. Enough of this. The state sponsors of terrorism are out. They're gone. Use that as a threat to the rest. Of course he wouldn't do that. I mean, I don't quite buy it.
Okay, here's my scenario. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Okay. Obama conducts a war, hits with missiles effectively these sites where they're developing the nuclear weapons, and gets Ahmadinejad, gets killed publicly,
Okay. Humiliated,
maybe not as bad as Gaddafi, but everybody knows he's dead and that we got him.
Mm-hmm.
And the Republicans nominate Mitt Romney.
Well, if Obama reads Atlas Shrugged, becomes an objectivist, yeah, I vote for him.
But that whole scenario has to be knocked out Iran,
read Atlas Shrugged, become objectivist, then I vote for him.
But I'm thinking the first two elements of my scenario
plausible. I would say, you know, let him, okay, finally you did something good. You somewhat redeemed your presidency, and that's it. Out. Next. You know.
Now, here's my other theory.
I don't know if I could walk up and vote for Romney. That's the thing. I don't think so.
I don't know if I could
vote for Romney. I don't know if I can get the energy to actually walk to the place and... Yeah, do it.
Now, here's my other scenario, right? I actually wonder whether Iran is exempt from Obama's usual it's kind of established predisposition to help the Arab Spring movement, right?
Or what they call the Muslim winter.
Maybe.
Arab
but
Spring Muslim Winter.
If you think about it, Iran seems to be different than its neighbors, or at least this is the popular misconception.
Iran is openly aggressive towards us. The others aren't.
Well,
the Saudis
okay,
are our friends.
But
you know.
But hear out my theory, okay? Yeah. So my theory is that because there has been a popular uprising in Iran that is not a pro-Islamic
necessarily,
element,
even
right?
though if you corner them, they'll say that it is, but it's not really. It's anti-totalitarian, anti.
To me, Iran seems to be one of the places in.
It used to be
the Middle East where.
It used to be a little more.
But where the government is more Islamic than the revolutionaries,
right.
So that if we were to topple this leader,
true.
The outcome would be different than it has been in Libya
possibly.
And Egypt. Where you'd end up with a less Islamic regime.
I will say this. A shocking thing that I saw after 9/11 was Iranians, youthful Iranians, with a candlelight vigil for the victims of 9/11. That's the only thing I've ever seen in the Middle East like that. That's pretty telling about the possibility that they may, you know, that the people themselves might be better than the others.
Alexander here is pointing out that I have to change my nice little scenario. It says, Ahmadinejad isn't the power center in that country. Killing him would be irrelevant. He says Khamenei, of course, is the supreme leader.
The
mullahs. And the guy who controls. And you're right, Alexander. In one of the articles that I read, it said that in terms of Iran actually making the step to develop the weapons, that it would have to be Khamenei who makes that final call.
Yeah, get the mullah. The mullah, you know, out, and I'll say something, but I didn't say it.
You are bad. I have deemed this show for general audiences on Blog Talk Radio,
say it,
and I don't.
But
want
you
to
understand
go
what
any,
I'm saying.
You
gotta knock them out. Absolutely, he's just a figurehead puppet out there doing his thing.
You know, I moderated a panel on Friday.
Oh.
This is the first time I moderated
exactly.
a panel.
I wouldn't do that.
And one of the panelists, you know, I guess I'm not as sensitive to it. I counted only one F-bomb. This one panelist used the F-word, I don't know, maybe five times or something during the course of her
presentation. I wouldn't even use it publicly, at least.
Yeah.
Maybe. It depends.
So I think I'm fairly polite. Only when I get really upset do I use euphemisms for profanity.
Alexander points out, amusingly, those mullahs work and live in Qom, not Tehran, so we need a Qom bomb. Yeah, that's all.
Well, and they say in Qom is where they, you know, have the mountain where they're going to be hiding all this stuff. But I didn't realize that it was getting that desperate that within 12 months that all the stuff would be hidden and they wouldn't even be able to get it. They
well,
have these bunker buster bombs, but I guess the bunker buster bombs are...
We can stop them, clearly, but do we have the will?
Yeah.
They have the will to kill, do we?
Well, and that's the thing, too. It says the U.S. could do it on their own. That's why I love in The Guardian. It says the U.S. could do it on their own, but they won't. That we're so wimpy. We won't take a unilateral action at all. And we can't even just do it with the U.K. We've got to get all these other people
We could wipe the enemy off the face of the earth if we wanted to.
But we won't. Anyway, I was pleasantly surprised that we might be considering this. And that was just a little bit of the moral of the story. I don't know if people are going to be swayed.
Joshua
by...
says that he read an article in Washington Times that Iran already has nukes. I wouldn't be shocked either, because I remember when it went nuclear power last year, and that's why I made that cartoon, Iran, with all the presidents, you know, in the nuclear symbol. And who's to say that they don't?
Right.
I don't know. I mean, the fact is, the way I thought about it over the years is we'll know they have nukes when they use them.
I don't understand why we should. I mean, the limited information that we have, we should think of that as only the tip of the iceberg.
Exactly.
And that's why I don't understand why anybody can say, oh, it won't be for 10 years before they're a military threat. That was Gary Johnson's position when I was on that call with him, that conference call. He said, well, I don't think Iran's going to be a threat for 10 years. And then
based
even
on
then,
what?
They're, you know, we're
based
not
on
their
him
first
not,
target.
Based on him not studying the situation.
Well, and then, you know, Haaretz, which you would assume is very concerned to get at the truth. They did not know what apparently the Guardian UK knew, which is that they do have enough fuel, enough enriched uranium for a couple nuclear weapons.
And that's all they'd want to need.
Yeah. So that it could be that the Washington Times is keeping up on it.
Well, Washington Times is very good with these things. They
maybe we have a domestic newspaper that can do it. Maybe the Wall Street Journal,
Bill
which Gertz. I subscribe to, is
Bill
the
Gertz,
wrong
a reporter from Washington Times. He's very good. Bill Gertz.
I subscribed to the Wall Street Journal thinking that was going to be a good all-around news source, and then I keep looking elsewhere for my information. Okay, so Joshua confirms that that's true, and this is a new caller. That's the same call. I don't know what happened exactly there. Someone must have gotten disconnected. Okay. Let's go on to our next story. Let's talk about Obamacare, which is just another wonderful, pleasant discussion. Obama wants to talk. Oh, Deborah first, she says, why do they say 10 years?
So they don't have to do anything.
Yeah.
That's it. That's why they say that. Because the fact is, if this report comes back and they're deep in, it'll be a challenge to us. It's like, damn, we have to actually do our job? You know, the U.S. government.
Well, it could be 10 years, but then it's only 12 months until they bury the stuff that they're going to be working on for 10 years. So a lot of good it's going to do us. We won't be able to stop them.
It's inevitable
after 12 months' time.
Unless we stop it, that they will use nuke on us, on Israel. Why wouldn't they?
So are we all ready for some law? Switch from foreign policy to law? Yeah? Okay. Okay, so here we go. This is Obamacare. If you recall, we have talked on this show, and I've also talked about on my blog. If you go to my blog at don'tletitgo.com and you Google Obamacare, you will find some posts there where I talk about Randy Barnett's argument that about the unconstitutionality of Obamacare based on the Commerce Clause. The argument, in essence, says that there must be limits to Congress's power pursuant to the Commerce Clause. And if they don't declare, if the Supreme Court doesn't declare the Patient Protection Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare, if they don't declare that to be unconstitutional, that amounts to saying that there is no limit at all on Congress's power under the Commerce Clause. Now, the limit that Barnett suggests the court takes up is a distinction between activity versus inactivity. And it goes as follows. It says, look, if somebody is deciding not to purchase health insurance, that does not amount to an activity. As a matter of fact, that is inactivity. You are failing to buy something. So if you are choosing not to engage in activity, you should not be able to be regulated. Regulated is usually reserved for people who have chosen voluntarily to perform some sort of activity. Then you can regulate it. So he's saying that the individual mandate forcing you to do something affirmatively, forcing you to go out there and buy health insurance, that is unconstitutional because it is not regulating activity. It's forcing you to engage in activity that you wouldn't have chosen to engage in otherwise. So now what we have is a different sort of challenge. It is a challenge based on the spending clause. And analogously, the people who are raising this challenge are saying that Congress's power under the spending clause, which presumably allows Congress to spend to, quote, promote the general welfare, that power is also limited, and that the Obamacare legislation, Patient Protection Affordable Care Act, that it would run afoul of that limitation as well. The argument that I have is from an amicus brief filed with the Supreme Court of the United States pursuant to the petition for the writ of certiorari, cert for short, and this is from the United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit, and that case has already been ruled on by the 11th Circuit, so it is ready for review. The amici that are filing this, there's two different organizations that combined to write this brief. It's the Center for Constitutional Jurisprudence, which is associated with Claremont, and the Pacific Legal Foundation, which is supporting Matt Sissel, whom you may have heard of as a litigant. So the authors of this, we've got signed on here Edwin Meese, Timothy Sandifer, John Eastman, Anthony Casa, and Karen Lee, some of whom I've had the pleasure of meeting and talking to at different times. Now, in terms of the question that's presented in the brief, these briefs always start out with these very complex, long, long, long questions presented. It's one big long thing that's a question. The essence of the question presented in this brief is, how much can Congress do under the auspices of the spending power, does it have limits? That's really the basic question that they're asking. The language is a lot more complex than that. By the way, you know, again, if you go to my blog at don'tletitgo.com, the most recent post is the post for today's show that you're listening to right now. And at the bottom of that post, I've included a link to this brief. If you want to read it for yourself, it's actually quite fun. Because what this brief does is it starts out by talking about a parable. There's a story about a camel. I don't know if you've heard this one. They talk about the proverbial camel's nose under the tent. They are referring to a proverb that was related by Barry Goldwater in 1958. It happens to be an Arabian proverb. We're talking about camels. And this is what Barry Goldwater said. He said, quote, "If the camel once gets his nose in the tent, his body will soon follow," end quote. And at the time there, he was warning about government involvement in education. But here, what the amicus brief is talking about is it's talking about government involvement in providing subsidies for various things for people. So they say here, you know, let's talk about the proverbial camel's nose under the tent. What began as a very small step of upholding a federal program to stop the spread of Great Depression-era unemployment from state to state has now metastasized into a whole usurpation of the police power, which is the power to regulate health and safety of the people. So what the brief does is the brief goes ahead and relates first the whole history of spending under the Constitution. And at the very beginning, we've got first Title III of the Social Security Act of 1935. There was a constitutional challenge to that act. And I don't know if you know this, at first, the Social Security Act of 1935 was passed only to assist with unemployment benefits. And they upheld it because unemployment at the time was thought to be spreading from state to state, right? So it became an interstate matter. Normally, up until that point, you would think something like unemployment benefits would be a state matter. The states could do it if they wanted to or not. And, you know, we could talk about, you know, obviously I would disagree with the state doing this as well, you know, redistributing wealth. But, you know, in our federal government, you know, our republic, our constitutional republic, they set up the separation of powers, not only between the different branches of the federal government, but also the states were supposed to be performing certain functions and the federal government other functions. Clearly, the federal government was not supposed to be dealing with things like redistributing wealth. So the only way that this was able to be upheld was on this rationale that unemployment was spreading from state to state during the Depression, and that they wanted to go ahead and stop this. So that's how the camel first got its nose in the tent. Then there was another provision of the Social Security Act, which is what we always think of more, which is retirement benefits. And the court went ahead and on the same day extended its ruling from just mere unemployment benefits to retirement benefits and cited some case called Butler, but then it says circularly it cited that other case in which it upheld the unemployment benefits. Here's the full extent of the analysis. Quote, "Spreading from state to state, unemployment is an ill, not particular but general." They have to put the word general in there because of the general welfare. It says, "which may be checked if Congress so determines by the resources of the nation. But the ill is all one or at least not greatly different whether men are thrown out of work because there is no longer work to do or because the disabilities of age make them incapable of doing it," end quote. So that was a quotation from a case called Helvering in which the court upheld on the same day as that previous case, Stewart, the other provision of the Social Security Act. So now they say the, you know, camel's got its four legs into the tent, right? Not soon, I mean, actually, it's actually 30 years later when you've got Medicare and Medicaid as amendments to the Social Security Act. Interestingly enough, nobody has challenged Medicare and Medicaid on constitutional grounds. So I guess by 30 years later, we just all accept this And lo
which
and
is
behold,
the plan.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, and how in the world could the original rationale that the unemployment was spreading from one state to another have ever been applied to the provision of health care to people? That original rationale that they, you know, got the little nose under the tent, completely gone. So I really like this brief because
it's like a Trojan camel.
You know, explains very simply. So then it says in the brief verses, we know how the camel story ends. The Bedouin master awakes in the middle of the night, completely outside the tent in the cold, as we will if the camel is not stopped. So then they go ahead and talk about your basic separation of powers principle. In particular, just point out, they quote Hamilton to the effect that the courts were designed to be an intermediate body between the people and the legislature in order, among other things, to keep the latter within the limits assigned to their authority. And then they're saying that for half a century, presidents were very good at keeping congressional power in check. And then for another three quarters of a century that the court did this. But then came a case, South Dakota versus Dole, in which they went ahead and allowed more spending to be done. Actually, probably, you know, all the cases, the Stewart and the other case that I just cited, were signs that there was no longer going to be limitations imposed by the court on the spending power. Now, in this case, they say, look, there has got to be a limitation on this power. The spending power cannot be unlimited. And in fact, the brief cites Justice Kennedy from a case just last year in 2010, United States versus Comstock, in which Kennedy says the following, quote, the limits on the spending power have not been much discussed, but if the relevant standard is parallel to the Commerce Clause cases, then the limits and the analytical approach in those precedents should be respected, end quote. So Kennedy, who's often thought to be a swing vote on the court, he himself has in mind the idea that there should be some limits here. And so what this brief hopes to do is to invite the court to take up the question whether this does exceed the limits. Now, why would it exceed the limits? You could say that just in general, the spending clause has limits, and at a certain point they go beyond their spending for purposes that they shouldn't be spending on, and that's it. But here the brief gives options of having a more narrowly tailored approach, and apparently there is a test for the spending clause and the appropriateness of powers exercised under the spending clause from a case called Dole. And it's a two-prong test. One has to do just with the substance of the spending as such. And then the second prong of the test has to do with what's called coercion, whether there was coercion under it. So I went and looked up the Dole case. And in terms of the first prong, it says, of course, that the spending must be in pursuit of the general welfare. Now, courts will be very generous in interpreting what constitutes a general welfare, but it has to be in pursuit of the general welfare. Also, if Congress desires to condition the state's receipt of federal funds, it must do so unambiguously, enabling the states to exercise their choice knowingly, cognizant of the consequences of their participation. So that's the second part of the first prong. And then the third is that the conditions on federal grants could be illegitimate if they are unrelated to the federal interest in particular national products or programs. So they have to be sufficiently related to this interest in the general welfare. So that's all the standard stuff. And it could be that you could challenge whether the Obamacare legislation falls under even that rubric there. That, you know, because there are, you know, conditions on states' receipts of funds pursuant to Obamacare. That's part of the way that Obamacare gets done what it wants to get done. It attaches all kinds of strings to these grants to the states with respect to Medicaid in particular. So what is this coercion prong about, right? It's got to be non-coercive. They say that in some circumstances, this is reading from Dole, again, the precedent opinion. It says, in some circumstances, the financial inducement offered by Congress might be so coercive as to pass the point at which pressure turns into compulsion. Now, in the particular case in Dole, they were concerned with whether Congress could take away 5% of the funds that were obtainable under some highway grant programs as if the state didn't agree to change its drinking age. Because there was South Dakota was going to allow 19-year-olds to buy beer that had lower amounts of alcohol in it. And if they did that, they were going to lose 5% of the funds that they would get under the highway grant programs from the federal government. So in that particular case, the Supreme Court said, no, it's not coercion. Here's the Supreme Court actually quoting from precedent here. Quote, every rebate from a tax when conditioned upon conduct is in some measure a temptation. But to hold that motive or temptation is equivalent to coercion is to plunge the law in endless difficulties. The outcome of such a doctrine is the acceptance of a philosophical determinism by which choice becomes impossible. Till now, the law has been guided by a robust common sense which assumes the freedom of the will as a working hypothesis in the solution of its problems. So basically they're saying, look, the fact that the federal government is making money conditional upon you satisfying certain conditions, then that's not coercion. That's temptation maybe, but you still have free will. You can decide whether to accept those conditions and take the money or just refuse the money. In the particular case, Dole, Congress has offered relatively mild encouragement, said the court. So that was Dole. So then the question is there coercion under the Obamacare legislation? Now, what the amicus brief recommends is that the coercion claim, Florida is claiming that it's being coerced, that claim should be considered against the broader spending clause backdrop because they agree that viewed in isolation, it seems silly to say that a gift of funds can be coercive. But here's, I think, where the brief gets very clever, I think very smart. It says, the coercion prong should not be viewed in isolation. It exists against a backdrop of a limited spending power and in the context of federalism. When, as with the case of the expanded Medicare program under consideration here, the federal government grabs tax revenues from a state's own citizens, then return some portion of those revenues to further police power purposes that fell within the state's jurisdiction in the first place, and attaches to that gift of federal funds some regulatory condition that the federal government could not impose directly, the transaction is inherently coercive. So did you hear that? And this is apparently an argument that originated maybe with Richard Epstein, because that's the article that they cite afterwards. Epstein is the University of Chicago-based attorney, so law professor, very respected scholar. So here we've got the federal government grabbing your money, your tax dollars, and they say, oh, states, we'll give you back some of the money. And yeah, you're spending it. This is money you're going to be spending on functions that you, the states, normally should be doing. But we're going to put a whole bunch of strings attached to it. We're going to put a lot of conditions on it so that we can have our dream of Obamacare, which will eventually become universal health care. We want that dream to be realized, and so you're going to help us do it. Otherwise, you're not going to get this money. Thank you very much. So the federal government's going to continue to tax. Right? And I think that's where the coercion comes in. You know, if you say, look, all these tax revenues are being grabbed by the government, and then we're only given back to you if you satisfy our conditions. I think that's where we've got some problem. We're getting here at the top of the hour, and actually we do have a new call. Hold on there just a minute because we're going to go ahead and take this up again right after the top of the hour. Again, this is Amy Peekoff talking to you. The show is Don't Let It Go Unheard. And right now we are talking about the new challenge to the Obamacare legislation, namely a challenge based on the spending clause. And like I said, this challenge is based on the fact that any power that the Congress has under the Constitution is limited. The spending clause power is no exception to that. And in particular, the amicus brief that I'm looking at, which is from both the Center for Constitutional Jurisprudence and the Pacific Legal Foundation, they are arguing that there's certain strings that the federal government would have to attach under Obamacare to the states in order for the states to get these block grants of money, it amounts to coercion because of the strings that they're attaching to it. That's the type of argument that they want the Supreme Court to take up. Now, they say that this coercion, that it is particularly true that it's coercion when the gift is massive and it amounts to a large percentage of the total funds that the state receives from the federal government. So they want to go ahead and have certiorari granted by the Supreme Court, resolve the split among the circuits on the ongoing vitality of the coercion prong of the analysis from this prior precedent called Dole. And they want to give the doctrine enough jurisprudential heft to serve as a meaningful check on an intrusive congressional action, place the doctrine squarely in the context of the concepts of federalism and limited enumerated powers. So, what does this amount to? First of all, the brief does not challenge the propriety of having the states administer Medicaid or similar sorts of programs. Now, you and I, where we think the proper functions of government are limited to your police, courts, military, things that actually protect individual rights, that not even a state government should be in the process of redistributing wealth or creating a so-called right to health care, you would still disagree with that. But here, what this brief attempts to do is, within the current constitutional framework, say, look, this function of providing something for the general welfare on that level, it comes under what's called a police power. It was traditionally held by the states. And what you have under Obamacare is you have the federal government grabbing up a whole bunch of tax money and saying, no, we're not going to give it to you unless you meet our conditions. What the brief is saying is that that is coercive, and if it is coercive, then it is in violation of Supreme Court precedent of Congress's limitations under the spending clause. It sounds like a good argument to me in terms of, you know, the merits, the constitutional merits. Is it the sort of argument that we ideally would want to be have made in the court? No, ideally you'd say, look, Obamacare is a piece of legislation that violates individual rights, period, end of story. That's not where we are right now in our constitutional framework, unfortunately. So this is what we have.
It's created redistribution of health.
Redistribution of health?
That's
yeah,
what
yeah, they're trying to redistribute health, try to redistribute health care. Now, I've got a question mark next to one caller here, so I'm hoping it's going to work. I'm going to try to unmute you. We'll see if it works. Hi, are you there? You're on the show if you are.
Hi, Amy.
Hi, how are you? Yes, I can hear you.
Good. That's really interesting to hear what you had to say about the coercion. And I think you really had a good point with the idea that the coercion initiates with the power to tax.
Well, no, and that I can't take credit for that. That is in the brief itself. So our good people over at the Center for Constitutional Jurisprudence and at the Pacific Legal Foundation, Tim Sandifer over there, had a lot to do with that argument right there. So it wasn't me, but it makes sense, right? Because you say, okay, you know, they look at the entire context. I like the fact that this brief looks at the context and says it's not just the federal government withholding a gift. It's in the context of the fact that the federal government has already grabbed all this money from a state's citizens and says, nah, we won't give it back to you unless, right? Now, you know, they don't have nah in a brief because it's a brief and it's beautifully written and it's supposed to go before the Supreme Court. But that's in essence, you know, what they're saying the federal government is doing. And it seems like it's a good argument for coercion there, don't you think?
Yeah, but in a way, it doesn't seem to go far enough because I find that it makes things more clear sometimes when you consider them on a personal level. So, like, if I were to hold a gun to someone's head and demand that they empty out their bank account and give it all to me, if I tell them that they can have some of it back on certain conditions, or if I just give some of it back to them, either way, I've still used coercion. And I don't know, I mean, it's a little bit more oppressive in the first case than the second, but I don't think that it's really fundamentally that different if I take all of it and then give some back and whether or not I can attach conditions to it. So it's, what do you think about that?
I think you're trying to make winnable arguments, like, you know, like Romney's electable. This is a winnable argument. That's why they,
well, I mean,
they don't go far enough.
Now,
they don't go fundamental.
It is an amicus brief, so you don't have to argue exactly as your standard legal brief. And, you know, they do use the proverb of the camel's nose. And it's very clever. It's fun to read. It's a short brief. I recommend it. But I was surprised that they did use this language about grabbing. I mean, they use the word grabs. The government grabs tax revenues.
Yeah.
So I thought that
that's
was
really good.
Now, if somebody grabbed your money and they gave it right back to you, there was a rights violation, but if they gave it right back to you with no conditions, you know, it's not as bad as if they said, well, I'll give it back to you only if you satisfy certain conditions of mine. It sounds like a horrible episode from The Office. I can imagine Dwight, you know, grabbing your money and saying, I'll give it back to you only on certain conditions. That's the first thing that came to my mind if you talk about a personal level. But I like this. We're going to have to see if the Supreme Court takes it up and decides to do something with it. And I like the fact that it encourages the Supreme Court to take up this issue, not just because it's in the Obamacare litigation as it goes on throughout the country, but they're saying that there's a broader issue more generally with other courts in other contexts considering the so-called Dole analysis, this previous opinion. The previous opinion is called South Dakota versus Dole, Secretary of Transportation. It's a 1987 case. And the fact that there are other jurisdictions struggling to interpret the so-called coercion prong of that case gives us some hope maybe that the court will take this up, because it seems the issue seems to be posed so well, so starkly, so clearly. It'd be great if they took it up in this context.
Awesome.
Yeah, it's a good line of go ahead, sorry.
No, go on.
I think it's a good road to be going down. I think that's good.
Yeah. The less popular Obama gets, the more popular a challenge to Obamacare gets as well. I mean, I think that's something as well, because people are itching to do something, to roll back his everything that began from 3 years ago.
I mean, anything they can do to get this legislation invalidated on constitutional grounds. I mean, now that we've got two strong arguments that if they uphold this legislation, Congress's power with respect to either one or the other clauses, in effect, so if they uphold it and these very smart lawyers are correct, then that would mean there's no limit on Congress's power under either the spending clause or the commerce clause.
This is a power grab.
Now, mind you, there are some supposedly smart appellate judges in our country who have said, in effect, that's the case. There is no limitation. That's it, you know. And that's really sad.
Yeah, that's disturbing and frightening, frankly. And another thing, that this is a question I wanted to ask you, take advantage of my access to someone with legal expertise on
I'll
Constitution.
Try.
I've heard people say that the single payer, like if we had just simply full socialized medicine, that would not violate the Constitution because it wouldn't have this sticky matter of the individual mandate. And I just found that outrageous, that the Constitution might possibly allow for full socialized medicine. And now, and I've also seen a Rasmussen poll some time ago that showed some significant portion of the population thinks the Constitution as written now doesn't provide sufficient protection for individual rights, probably because they hear people saying things like socialized medicine would be okay under it. So do you agree with that? And then if so, what would you say we need to change in order to make it so it does provide better protections for our rights?
Now, what I do in this context is I defer to the experts. And when I saw Randy Barnett speak on the constitutional challenges to the Obamacare legislation when he came and spoke at the university where I'm at, he said explicitly that if they went ahead and had a universal payer system passed tomorrow, that there would be no problem. And, you know, the fact that in this brief, remember I mentioned that they said that there has been no constitutional challenge to either Medicare or Medicaid. That seems to reinforce this idea that if you just went ahead and had universal payer for everyone in the country, that it wouldn't be subject to the constitutional challenge that this legislation is. And that is scary. The interesting thing is that, and it was true, that legislation, a legislation that would just pass universal health care outright, that wasn't politically feasible at the time. Only this was politically feasible. So they said, okay, well, maybe we can't pass universal health care now, but what we can do is we can pass something that's going to inevitably give us universal health care. The scary thing is that I also heard in the last week from someone else who knows some constitutional law, Ron Rotunda. I heard from him that there's something in the Obamacare legislation that says that if it is not overturned as unconstitutional, is it if it's not invalidated or not repealed within a certain period of time, that supposedly it becomes irrevocable. Now, that provision itself might give rise to a constitutional challenge, because I don't know if it's constitutional to have legislation that can't be repealed according to the normal procedures laid out in the Constitution, right? It seems like you'd have to have a... Yeah. But they have tried every trick in the book to have this really be that, you know, camel's nose under the tent. I mean, I don't even know if it's the nose now. You know, at least we got the, with respect to health care, maybe Medicare and Medicaid were the camel's nose under the tent, and now we're putting the legs under or something, getting the whole camel in. Yeah. So, so yeah. It's, yeah,
wow, these people are just horrible. I mean, they're just terrible people, huh?
They are, and I mean, they did whatever they could to try to get their pet project and their dream.
The last 100 years.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Who was it? It was Kennedy had said that he was trying it for decades to have this done.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So I think Pelosi and Reid
tried
and them.
For 2 centuries. I think she'd been trying for 2 centuries. And finally, she did it. Pelosi.
Oh, I don't know. So we all cross our fingers. I mean, that's what we do in cases like this. And like I said, this brief was relatively simple to read. It was sort of entertaining and such, but you are still in dismay at the sort of arguments that we are constrained to making today in order to try to protect our rights in the courts. The fact that you have to make this really narrowly tailored coercion argument when, like I said, in fact, you should just be going in and saying, hey, this is a violation of individual rights.
Right.
Government should be able to do this, end of story. And all this paper and you know, stressing. And we have no idea. We have no idea how it's going to come out. Yes, you do have Justice Kennedy saying that, gee, it seems like there should be some limits on these powers. But we don't know what's going to happen when this case comes before Supreme Court. I'm actually kind of worried about it. So we do need to elect somebody who would repeal this. That is one concern in our – so if we go back to our scenario, right, we have Obama takes out not just Ahmadinejad but also Khomeini. And –
their nuclear
we have Mitt Romney, our father
Submit
of Romney,
Romney
Care. Submit Romney, the father of Romney Care, nominated as the GOP nominee.
Can't. Neither.
I don't know if we could still vote for Obama.
Can't vote for him. Can't vote for him.
I can vote against Obama
with someone.
What do you do?
Romney.
What do you do, Deborah?
Ah, I don't like that scenario. But I think that I would probably vote for Romney. Just, I'm not sure about it, but I'm kind of leaning towards that. I would vote for him because I think Obama is still less likely to repeal Obamacare than Romney is. And at the very least, he maybe wouldn't be going so aggressively after just destroying the country in the way that Obama is. So, I mean, just in order to stop a total absolute collapse, I would probably see Romney as a lesser evil, but it wouldn't be a really something that I'd be happy about choosing. You know, I mean, I'm not even sure that it would be good, because sometimes a bad Republican who's really weak and moderate like Romney is, or who's actually weak and leftist like Romney is, sometimes they can be worse because they get away with more since they're a Republican, and because they're just ridiculous. Weak policies get passed off as capitalism, and then people say, "What the hell was capitalism then?" So
right, they blamed the last 8 years on the capitalism, as if that was capitalism.
No, and this is the thing too. You know, if you go to Romney's website and you read his plan, and like I said, I read the 5-page executive summary of this 59-point plan, but he throws around the words free enterprise in there as if that's what he's the representative of, and he is no representative of a free enterprise. Nothing in there is bold. You know, this is a stark departure from Obama. Yeah. It is nothing like that.
And also, one thing, you know, if he becomes a nominee, it's basically the country is resigned to the fact of having socialized medicine because they will have nominated a guy who installed socialized
medicine. Well, here's the thing, though.
And
he
it will cancel each other.
You saw in the debate where they finally pinned him down and they made him actually promise to repeal it.
Yeah,
because nowhere in that 5-page summary did he...
He didn't actually... No,
he did. He used the word.
Okay.
He did.
Okay.
He finally did.
He coughed it up.
Yeah.
You know.
I don't think he wanted to promise to repeal it.
Now, he was talking about repealing Romneycare? Okay, I see.
You know, in that 5-page summary that I looked at a few weeks ago, he carefully worded it, and he said he would repeal legislation like Dodd-Frank, like Obamacare.
But you know, but one thing, if he becomes a nominee, if they go head to head, him and Obama, it's true. The socialized medicine aspect of the debate would be canceled out. Mm-hmm. You got two guys who, that's the killer. That's why you got to knock out Romney now. And you know what? I mean, the only reason why Kane is still surviving is because he's more likable and Romney's terrible. That's really the only thing. It's not really truly McCain. It's how terrible Romney is.
Yeah. Now,
I'll take Kane over Romney.
Absolutely, any day.
Yeah, no, I think right now I would still take Kane over Romney. And actually, I saw a funny thing today. Do you see Sunny Lohman? She put a video out saying that she was sexually harassed by Herman Kane.
Oh,
that.
Really?
Yeah, it was even though it was only over the television.
That's funny.
She says he looked at her in a way that made her feel uncomfortable. Then she plays a little clip of him smiling.
That's funny.
I'm going to harass you.
There was an article like on something called I can't remember the name of the publication, but it was an article saying that Herman Cain was accused of bludgeoning two women with a frozen turkey.
Right. I did read that. That's very funny.
No, they haven't been able to substantiate any of this. So as of now, I think I could still vote for him. What I want to see is I've got to go back and look at some of the footage of his debate with Newt Gingrich. I heard he did pretty well.
Okay.
I would assume that Gingrich sort of outclasses him a bit in terms of experience and knowledge, but
you know, he sat down with Nancy Pelosi on a couch about global warming for Al Gore. That's all y'all know about, you know.
Yeah, I'm no big fan of Gingrich either. A lot of people are saying Kane Gingrich for 2012. I don't want Kane Gingrich because I don't trust Gingrich as a manipulative vice president either.
Absolutely.
I don't think I want him. I'm going
to
go ahead and put you back on hold again, Deborah. If you want to chime in on the next story, you can. We're going to talk about Greece, if you're into that. Is Greece
movie?
The word or not? No, not them. I said Greece is the word, right?
Revolta.
Oh, yeah, John Revolta. The number to call us is 760-888-5817. If you want to get in on the discussion, we have talked about Iran's nuclear program and what we should do about it. We have talked about the spending clause challenge to Obamacare. And now we're going to try to figure out what in the world's going on in Greece. So here's the context. European Union agreed to a bailout of Greece, huge amounts of loan forgiveness, and there's a phrase apparently, and people in the financial services industry know this, they're saying that the banks, a lot of private banks in Europe, are taking a haircut, which means I guess they're only going to get part of the money that they were expecting. And in fact, they are being asked to forgive 50% of the loans that they granted to Greece. Now, all of this is conditioned on Greece making certain budgetary changes that I guess would allow the currency to remain stable, because the big question is whether Greece remains part of the euro or has to be kicked out from the euro. And if Greece can't remain within the auspices of the euro, there's supposed to be a lot of dire consequences that happen. So... Yeah. No, go ahead. So this is what's happened. A lot of people will say, okay, well, that's bad enough. Then there appear to be stirrings within Greece as to whether or not they want to make the budgetary changes that are required to make good on the promises in order to get these bailouts that they were just promised. So the story is November 6th, Wall Street Journal, Greece opposition rejects call for a bipartisan coalition. Now, why in the world do they need a bipartisan coalition? Well, here's the deal. The government, the ruling government in Greece, was headed by somebody named President Papoulias, and he is also a socialist, part of the Socialist Party. I guess he went ahead and, you know, secured the deal, got all the promises of the bailouts and everything. And then he went back and said, well, maybe we should have a referendum and have people vote as to whether they agree with this aid package. And there was this huge brouhaha, and they said, oh my gosh, no, you know, you can't have a referendum. We don't want you doubting your commitment to this aid package and to remaining within the euro, et cetera. So within his party, a lot of people were upset with him. They have, and you know, they don't have this here. In other countries, you always hear about whether they have a vote of no confidence in their leader, and then suddenly they have a new government. And this can happen, I guess, on any significant event. So Saturday morning, they went ahead and had a vote, and he did win, so he was able to remain in power. But then he nonetheless decided he would agree to step down in favor of a bipartisan coalition government that would go ahead and implement the changes that were necessary to conform to the deal, you know, to get all these bailouts. So in the meantime, there is the main opposition party.
The Nihilist Party?
Well, it's not called the Nihilist Party. It's called the New Democracy Party. And what they're calling for is early elections. Instead of having this new bipartisan coalition government that would be agreed to by the current president, instead they want to have early elections. And they also want to basically not commit to the changes, all of the so-called austerity measures that are called for under the aid package. The head of the Democracy Party is called Samaras, Mr. Samaras, and apparently the Prime Minister, George Papandreou, he briefed the President Papoulias earlier in the day of his intentions for a cross-party government that would implement a $179 billion of U.S. dollars aid package that was agreed to by the European leaders. He says, I will do whatever I can to help form a coalition government. This is the prime minister speaking. And he says, the October 26th decisions and obligations stemming from this are a condition for the country remaining in the euro. Now, the New Democracy Party, which says it welcomes the aid deal, opposes the austerity measures that the government has implemented since the start of the country's debt crisis last year, which it blames for pushing Greece into a deep and protracted recession. So they're having the same debate that we're having over here. They think that they need to spend, spend, spend in order to save their country. And that's the same sort of thing that's being called for here, most recently by Occupy Wall Street. So what is New Democracy? New Democracy wants to have their cake, namely the bailout, and eat it too. Namely, they want to forget these austerity measures. The New Democracy Party says, quote, with Mr. Papandreou's policies, he has condemned the country, end quote. It says, no program can proceed without the support of the people. That is why we must go to elections. So they want to have elections to decide whether or not they're going to do the things that are required.
Right.
Now, in the meantime, they want this Greek unity government because they want to avoid what they're characterizing as an early, messy debt default, an uncontrolled exit from the euro, which is a prospect that looms large in Athens right now. Now, they were going to have an open revolt within the Socialist Party because they had called, the current government had called for a referendum on the aid agreement, but now they've backed down. So that was pretty dumb for them to do. And now they've said, okay, we realize that we won't have a referendum on it. And instead, what we want to have is we want to have a coalition government. And that coalition government needs to be obligated to implement some of the austerity measures, the big ticket items that are required to continue to get this aid. Because apparently they were supposed to get another installment of aid. And they called it an aid tranche, T-R-A-N-C-H-E. that was blocked by Greece's Eurozone partners this week after there was a plan for the referendum raised, and it raised questions about the country's commitment to push through with the loan agreement and the necessary fiscal and structural reforms. They say without this aid, Greece is going to run out of money by the middle of December. In his remarks to reporters, the prime minister clearly indicated that the newly formed government would have the power to pass implementing legislation relating to the EU aid deal, confirming differences with the New Democracy Party over these powers. On the other hand, the opposition party says that they want to pass only the loan deal itself, and then they want to have elections and then decide whether to have the austerity measures. So this is the conflict that's going on in Greece right now. Now, another story that I have, which was a little bit later on November 6th, they said that the mandate of this new coalition government is another sticking point. The prime minister insisted that any coalition government should have the power to pass the implementing legislation. New Democracy says that the new government should only ratify the loan agreement and then go to these elections to allow the newly elected government to determine the necessary policies. The latest story that I saw today is that they have agreed on a coalition government, but the current president will not step down until commitments to implement the deal are made. So it seems that it's going to happen, but the thing that got me about this story, which I love, is the current government, both the president and the prime minister, are from the Socialist Party. The Socialist Party...
being the grown-ups here.
They're being the grown-ups in relation to another party that's called the New Democracy
Party,
which I guess is the nihilist party. They're more ready to implement the so-called austerity measures. I mean,
EU is realizing that Greece is bad for you. What do you think?
I don't know. So then the question is, okay, so here it is. You've got Greece asking for money, getting the promise of the money, saying we'll give you the money on certain conditions. You have to pass these so-called austerity measures. And the question is, are they going to do it? Do they want to take it? Or are they just, I don't know what they think is their alternative at this point. Yeah.
They're, you know, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
They're trying to call the shots when they are the ones in absolute deep, you know what.
Anyway, so the question is, how much do they represent the parody of Greece that was on Saturday Night Live this week? Papandreou says Alexander. Thank you, Alexander Papandreou. That's very nice.
I said Greece is bad for you, right?
Greece is bad for you.
The EU is realizing that Greece is bad for you. Anyway, it's the second, third time, anyway.
Yeah. Now, they want to return to the drachma in Greece, I guess. But I know that the European Union countries don't want them to leave. They think it's going to be some sort of a disaster for the euro. So
they think.
I don't know.
And this is not a disaster?
Yeah. Well, and I think Greece is smoked no matter what. They need to just get with the program and stop all the spending. There was a great spoof on SNL about it. Saturday Night Live this weekend. And the question is, how like the spoof is the reality? So let me give you the spoof. So the spoof is you've got all the Greek gods convening to discuss the financial crisis. And of course, Zeus is holding court and he's in charge of the whole thing. He's the master of ceremonies. And he says, oh, you know, the Greeks, you must be as surprised as I am that they're in this financial crisis because they're hardworking workers. They work 3 days a week, 1 hour a day for 45 years. They're so dedicated, right? But he says, okay, we have to figure out how this could have happened. Where's the Greek god of finance? And so then they have, you know, oh, I'm not in charge of finance. I'm not. And there's all the different gods and different kinds of jokes, including a lot of sex jokes.
So the party god?
Yeah, finally it's the Dionysus, the god of partying and drinking.
Party, yeah. Who just came off an orgy.
Yeah, he just came off of some orgies and stuff. And he says, I have the spending thing under control. And he says, what was the other part of it? Oh, savings, you know?
No, not so much.
So they didn't want to, of course, save or implement these austerity measures. So I guess they had Klaus, the German god of finance who came in and he went ahead and said that we'll go ahead and give you a bailout if you have these austerity measures. And they said, no, you know, we just want the money and don't make us do anything. And he said, okay.
which might happen.
gives them the money and bailout and everything. So, but what does Zeus say? Zeus says, we started democracy. We can end it if we want.
That's a pretty good line. That is a good line.
Yeah. And I mean, in reality, you would say not that they, I mean, they did start democracy, yeah. but what they did is they sowed the seeds for Western civilization
yes,
as such.
Did. And look where they are today.
And could the domino effect from Greece, if they default on this and it's not just a haircut. Yeah.
And what's Greece doing about this?
It's not a haircut. Right. It's a complete shaving of the head bald, yeah. right? Instead of the
or
haircut.
Or even worse.
I don't know. Could the domino effect really precipitate this end? It's bad everywhere. There's graphs, if you go on the Wall Street Journal website, telling you all the horrible things that have been going on in the European markets, financial markets, with respect to the euro and the different countries' credit being downgraded and all these horrible events.
This is all coming to a head, all this socialism, all this crap that people have been misled about what government is about.
Now, Deborah here says, why in the world would the loss of a parasite be bad for the EU?
Well, Greece is bad for you, regardless, you know, in any way.
All I know is the people who have the euro think that if there is an uncontrolled, premature departure
someone
from the euro.
Someone will always take care of someone. Will, you know, I mean, that's what the euro, that's what the EU is about. You know, someone will always. It's like in any kind of situation. It's like someone will always bail them out. That's it. It's like, you know, you'll do something. Remember James Taggart? You'll do something.
Now, see, Deborah here, she says haircut or decapitation.
Yeah.
So she says what you were hesitating to say.
No, I wasn't hesitating. I was telling you with my finger, I think, across my neck.
Yeah, no, did not want to say it. Anyway, I think it's just really amazing that you can have a leader of a country going hat in hand
and demanding
to Europe and saying, hey, bail us out. Then they get the promise of the bailout. Then they go back to their own country and say, hey, let's have a referendum and see whether we want this or not.
They still think they can say something about it. I mean, and what are they doing about it? That's the question. They can take care of it. They can really do something about it. They can work. They can create. They can, you know.
Well, and here's the other thing. Can anything that they do, suppose you've got the leaders in Greece realize that they've got to implement, and apparently they have this deadline by the beginning of the year, before 2012, they have to pass a new budget and all these things. Suppose they realize that this has to be done to avoid an economic collapse. That doesn't mean that they're behind it morally. And so if they don't realize the moral impropriety of what they've been doing, can any of it survive anyway? I mean, they're just going
to
do the minimum to keep getting bailed out.
Yeah, they still think that they don't have to work hard to get themselves out of this mess. They still believe that. And the EU is probably letting them, you know, think this as well.
Yeah. Alexander says, imagine if they had to spend money on defense. Yeah. I mean, that's part of our problem, that we have been propping up defense budgets all around the world.
Europe has counted on us.
Yeah.
You know, for decades and decades.
And they've been able to have a lot more socialist-style governments without the financial consequences because they haven't had to spend the money on defense.
And Europe is against our socialized medicine as well because they won't get as much. You know.
Now, see, this is the sort of talk where we talk about the fact that we've been propping up their defense and we should stop and we shouldn't, you know, have our military spread all around the world and give them
they're
foreign
still in
aid.
Germany.
We're sounding like Ron Paul again, right?
Well, Ron Paul and, you know,
but he goes a lot further
and
says, let's and be friends
very,
with
very,
them.
Very, you know, isolated situations. He's right. Very isolated situation. But out of context, he's right.
Right. Oh, sadness. So that is the situation in Greece. So you tell me what's better, the Greek gods version? Or
I like
that
one.
At least I laughed while I watched the Greek gods version. But when you watch what has happened to Greece today.
Can the Greeks laugh at that? I don't know. Maybe not.
Well, the Greeks, of course, would say, oh, everybody always talks about the Greek gods, and that's a stereotype. But when I think of Greece, I don't think of the Greek gods. I think of Plato and Aristotle. So am I one rung in hell up according to the Greeks because I think of Plato and Aristotle instead of
they don't think of Aristotle anymore, at least.
Well, it doesn't seem that they are.
They don't appreciate
it. But, you know, I just think it's funny when the Socialist Party is the voice of reason, and they're saying that the Socialist Party is you know, basically going on the side of a very few right-wing candidates within the government. So that's it's a slim majority of the socialists combined with the right-wingers against the new Democrats that are maybe going to get this done. So it's still not a done deal. As I said, they have tentatively agreed on this coalition government, but before they have in place some commitments, then the president is not going to step down. So that's how things stand. Someone was saying that Italy is actually back in the picture, that maybe they're doing okay. And I don't know what this means in terms of financial markets and their health, because I am not a financial markets not even expert. I'm not even a neophyte in financial markets. He says that Italy's back in the picture. Their 10-year bond was sold at 6% and the spreads are rising. I assume that's good news, Robert. You'll have to go ahead and type and tell me that, yes, that means something, that they're doing better than they were. I think I heard recently that they rejected some sort of offer of a bailout, you know, the equivalent of a company saying, we don't want your TARP funds, go away.
Well, that's good.
And they wanted to do that because, yeah, that they
morally,
they wanted to get back on the right track. So that would be really nice if so. Okay. Are we ready for the case of all cases? Former Governor Jesse Ventura.
It's not the case of all cases. It's being sarcastic, but anyway.
That's right, I know.
You know, the former fake wrestler.
Yes, the former fake wrestler.
Who believes in fake conspiracy theories about 9/11, but go on.
So was Jesse Ventura a good governor?
I don't know. I think it was a one-termer, I believe. But every time I hear him, it's like he struggles to get words out of his mouth. I don't think he's that smart. You know?
He didn't sound terrible in the little press conference that I watched when he was talking about the case that we're going to discuss right now.
Yeah, just one more thing about the Loose Change, the movie, about, it's the 9/11 Truther movie. He said that opened his mind to the idea that there was something that our government was involved with, that Dick Cheney allowed 9/11 to happen. You know, Loose Change equals loose brains. And you fell for it. But again, if you're a fake wrestler, I guess you believe in fake attacks and fake wars and, you know.
Tom says the man was in Predator, for God's sake. Some respect, please. Did you see him in Predator?
I did.
You did?
Yeah, the Predator took him out, I believe.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did he die a heroic death?
I forgot.
Oh, gosh. Okay. So, apparently, Jesse Ventura decided he was going to sue the government because of being mistreated by the TSA, something we can all sympathize with. He filed the suit, I believe, in January, and then it was dismissed this week in the district court. They said that they did not have jurisdiction over his case. So the story that we all saw that was kind of passed around on Facebook, and some people were laughing and wondering, you know, what is gotten into this guy. He's so upset by the dismissal of the lawsuit that he has threatened to apply for dual citizenship so he can spend more time in his beloved Mexico, or he said he was considering running for president.
Of what country?
Of ours.
Oh,
yeah.
I thought,
yeah.
Iran or something.
Yeah. So he might run for president, or he might give up his citizenship and go to Mexico. He said definitely he's lost all patriotism, that he
planned. So why would he want to be president of a country he's lost all patriotism?
Maybe he
for?
Thinks that would be the last-ditch effort to convert it back to a country that he could believe in again.
So someone quotes him, I guess, from a movie. I ain't got time to bleed. I ain't got time to bleed. I remember that line, but was that in Predator? I don't know. Anyway, sorry.
Okay.
That's just a funny line.
Here, you could do the same voice for this one here. I was just about to read a quotation from him, but you go ahead. You go ahead.
I can't do it.
Please?
I can't.
He says, I will never stand for a national anthem again. I will turn my back and I will raise a fist. End quote. He said.
Will you stand for his beloved Mexico's anthem? Oh, man.
I mean, I don't know. You stand. Oh, you have enough tequila, you can't stand. So
he must run for president of a country he hates.
It says, Tom says he gets shot by the Predator right before the scene where they shoot the guns into the forest. I don't know what that means. Okay. Yeah, so that was from Predator. I ain't got time to bleed.
That's a funny line. I ain't got time to bleed.
So what is his case about? Well, his case is a challenge of the TSA and all the wonderful search techniques that you've heard about
airport. We could sympathize with it, right? I made a cartoon, Commander and Crutch, last year.
Yeah, the pat downs, the invasive pat downs, the scans, you know, that you have the full body scans that include all the pictures.
It seemed like this is just his excuse to condemn America. I mean, you're going to condemn America because of this? I mean, it's a terrible thing, but come on.
It maybe not.
The country's over.
I mean, and here's the thing. It is true that once you learn about someone that they're part of the truther movement, that they're sympathetic with the truther movement.
I have no respect.
But the question is there anything here? Has the United States become this fascist United States? He calls it the fascist states of America. Now, he says that the airport scans and the pat-downs amounted to unreasonable search and seizure, which I think a lot of us would say.
And Mexico is better, right?
Yeah, of course. A district judge threw out the lawsuit ruling it should have been filed in a circuit court of appeals, and we're going to talk about why. He said that with respect to him, he's got a titanium hip that was implanted in him in 2008. It sets off metal detectors. And that before the institution of these new pat-down and, you know, airport scanner procedures, agents previously used handheld wands to scan his body. He was subjected now to body pat-downs when the airport metal detector went off last November, and he says he hasn't flown since, and he won't fly commercially again unless these, procedures are discontinued. Outside the federal courthouse, he said that he hasn't decided whether to continue pressing the lawsuit. He's supposed to go file in the Circuit Court of Appeals. It says, this is the puzzling part, he said he wanted to make his case before a jury, not a panel of judges. Now, a panel of judges is what you get when you go to the Circuit Court of Appeals. The way the federal court system works here is typically you start at the district court level, and at the district court level, depending on your case, you'll be either before a single judge, a single district court judge, or in some cases, certain things can be decided by a jury. Then if the result, you don't like the result that you get there, or if either, you know, party to the lawsuit doesn't like the result there, you can make an appeal to the circuit court. Circuit court takes it and decides. They can decide to affirm it or not, and then if you don't like the outcome there, you can try to get the Supreme Court to take it, but the Supreme Court doesn't always have to take it. So you can get one appeal as a matter of right to the circuit court. So it is kind of unusual for a district court to tell you, sorry, you can't file your federal case here. You can't challenge the federal government in a federal district court. You have to go straight to a circuit court. But the curious thing is that he said he wanted to make his case before a jury, not a panel of judges, and it's not clear how he would have gotten his case before a jury. So I went ahead and looked up the opinion, and it turns out that it's Lou Rockwell's website, Lou Rockwell's website, that has the PDF of the United States District Court, District of Minnesota opinion in this case, and it's Jesse Ventura versus Janet Napolitano et al., and
versus the predator?
Yeah, in essence, what they're saying is that
he sees her as the predator, Janet Napolitano.
I guess so. I don't know. Alexander says, how can he fly commercially at all if he thinks the government will commandeer the plane to attack the country? That's a good question. Yeah, why would he do that?
For hell.
Oh, my gosh. In the lawsuit, it repeats some of the facts that we heard in the article there. It says Governor Ventura contends that he's been subject to such pat-down searches, you know, these invasive pat-down searches, and that he will be subject to whole-body imaging because of his hip implant, despite the fact that he poses no threat to airline safety. Now, there are what is called standard operating procedures. That is the TSA document that requires implementation of these enhanced security processes. A footnote in this opinion says that these are secret for reasons of national security. So nobody, you know, at least not Jesse Ventura, not the district court, they don't know the details of these enhanced screening processes or the so-called standard operating procedure. What Ventura wants is he wants a declaratory judgment that the TSA and the Department of Homeland Security have violated his Fourth Amendment rights, and then he wants an injunction against these searches and seizures. He wants them to be stopped. So then the question is, does this court have jurisdiction? And at first they say if the government at all raises the question of whether jurisdiction is proper, the court can decide it without even looking at the facts. So it doesn't matter whether any of the material facts in the case are disputed. The trial court can go ahead and evaluate the merits of the jurisdictional claims. And in essence, it says, no, it has no jurisdiction. Why? Because there is a statute that says that only the circuit courts of appeals can review the orders that the TSA promulgates. Okay, so it says the relevant statute provides that, quote, a person disclosing a substantial interest in an order issued by the Secretary of Transportation, paren, or the Undersecretary of Transportation for Security with respect to security duties or powers designated to be carried out by the Undersecretary, may apply for review of the order by filing a petition for review in the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, or in the Circuit Court of Appeals of the United States for the circuit in which this person resides or has its principal place of business. In other words, you have to go straight to the Circuit Court if you want to challenge the TSA. Now, in the brief, there is an intelligent argument. It's not some bogus argument. You've got Jesse Ventura's lawyer arguing that the TSA standard operating procedure is not an order for purposes of that section that I just read to you. That section I read to you is 49 U.S.C. section 46,110 subsection A. There's way too much U.S. code out there. So it's not an order because the order has to be final, it has to contemplate immediate compliance, it has to be public, and it has to be based on an administrative record that permits meaningful appellate review. And that's a four-prong test from a precedent called City of Pierre. So he says on all these grounds, it doesn't amount to an order. Of course, not surprisingly, the government here says that it is an order. Yeah, my voice was breaking up. I'm sorry. I'm getting too excited, and I'm probably not speaking into the mic. Can everyone hear? Yeah, everyone can hear me better now. Sorry about that. This is getting me. So, not surprisingly, the court does find that it is an order, and it says that there's two different senses of the term order, and the sense of the word order in that section that I just read you is broader because it provides for judicial review in that section. So then what exactly is an order? I think the thing that's interesting about the order is because an order under that test is supposed to be public, and in this case, it's not public. The standard operating procedure is not public because they say it's a national security risk for it if it was made public, exactly what it is that the TSA is being told they're supposed to do. So here's the court on that. It says, although the details of the challenged standard operating procedure are not publicly available, there is sufficient information about what the procedure requires to allow challenges to it. And as discussed previously, this other code section's requirement that orders be served on affected parties doesn't apply. And it says, so the standard operating procedures requirements are sufficiently public to comply with the tests. Moreover, it said the court had said that he cannot challenge whether there could be jurisdiction additionally in the district court to challenge the TSA. He cannot even ask that question. Even though the section that I just read you doesn't say that you can't go to a district court, it just provides for it in the appellate court. Why? All the other courts have held that it can be only in the appellate court, and this court assumes that by specifying that you go straight to the circuit court, that they mean to exclude the district court. So that's where Jesse Ventura actually has something to his challenge. He is being prevented from bringing a case at the district court level. Now, if he was at the district court, would that mean that he could get a jury trial? No, I don't necessarily think so. I was looking around. I was trying to find an instance of somebody challenging the constitutionality of a government procedure on Fourth Amendment grounds and getting a jury trial. Typically, the Fourth Amendment cases in which you see a jury trial are Fourth Amendment cases in which somebody is convicted of a crime and then they have a right to a jury trial, and so that maybe some of the issues relevant to the Fourth Amendment could be decided by a jury. Maybe the application of certain, you know, Fourth Amendment requirements could be decided by the jury, but I don't see that he would necessarily get a jury. Now, does that mean that we shouldn't be concerned that the TSA has insulated itself from a certain level of review? No, I don't think so. I think that there is something that you would get by having it reviewed at the district court level. It is true that you're not having to have it reviewed by a panel of judges. You're having a single judge. What is the benefit of that? Well, think about this. Suppose you go and you are able to challenge the TSA at the district court level, and you put your case before the district court judge. You don't get your jury. Doesn't matter. District court judge agrees with you that there is an issue here and that perhaps the federal government has violated the Fourth Amendment with these procedures. You get a ruling on that issue. And perhaps that's going to be somewhat persuasive or create some momentum with other judges in the circuit. And, you know, it might create some momentum to getting these procedures overturned as unconstitutional. It doesn't mean that it's going to create any sort of presumption of unconstitutionality by the district court level, because it's still going to be a question of law. And so the appellate court is going to be able to consider the issue de novo all over again. But it might subject the government to more expense in defending itself, more embarrassment in defending itself. You know, if you have a whole lot of cases at the district court level and people happen to be winning them, that could be embarrassing for the court. So maybe they think that if you've got the appellate court judges are going to be more experienced, more seasoned, more likely to side with the government than the district court judges.
He's somewhat famous.
So yeah, do I think that Jesse Ventura was right to be upset because he didn't get his jury?
He should have been upset that he got killed by the predator. You know, that's what's really pissing him off.
But I do. I'm a little concerned that the TSA has insulated itself by statute from one level of challenge. I mean, it's nice to say, okay, I've got my right to go to the district court, have my case reviewed there. If I don't like the outcome, I go ahead and appeal. And then we've got more judges looking at it. I get more days in court, more people to tell me whether I'm right or whether I'm crazy. You know, I think that would be a good thing. If you want to talk about this issue and chime in and tell me whether you think that we're losing something if we don't get to litigate the district court level, it's 760-888-5817. Again, that's 760-888-5817. I do think that there is something that we lose. I mean, you know, first of all, after 9/11, instead of fighting a proper war of self-defense, our former president, George W. Bush, creates Department of Homeland Security.
He grew government, went big on us.
Yeah, the TSA. And like we said, in the last couple of years, the TSA has instituted this new standard. I think it's within the last year, this standard operating procedure has taken effect where you either get the nudie pictures or the what I call the freedom fondle.
The guy who pushed for the TSA, remember? He's now completely saying it's terrible.
He's against it.
It should be wiped out of existence.
But now there is this statute that says that if you want to challenge the constitutionality of what the TSA does, you have to go straight to the circuit court. Mind you, it might also not be very convenient for you to get to the circuit court. It depends how big your circuit is, how far you live away from the seat of the circuit court. So there's those things to consider as well. But all of this, you've got the TSA, you've got the laws preventing the challenges. This is all to avoid fighting a proper war of self-defense, right? Naming the enemy, going after the key state sponsors of this terrorism, and going after them in a decisive way such that you can use the few that you go after, or maybe just go after one or two. Use them as examples and say, the rest of you guys, leave us alone, because if you don't, this is what's going to happen to you.
Right?
Do that. And then if you need to have some, you know, enhanced security screenings in the meantime while you're sorting all this out, there's something that you can do that's clear, which is admit that some sort of profiling is appropriate.
Yeah.
Right? So, but instead of profiling, they'd rather institute this standard operating procedure, make anybody at random subject to going through these scanners and who knows what radiation's involved in those. Some people have said that there's fairly little danger. But what if you travel a lot?
And who's telling us this?
Yeah.
The government.
I think they've made them a little more private than they used to. At first, it was a lot less private, but still, you know, these scanners, they can see all sorts of things.
It is all, again.
And the pat-downs. The pat-downs have been the most humiliating for some people, and you do hear the horror stories. Some of the horror stories are on that InfoWars page, and then I just dismiss them. But
they just...
I've heard horror stories that are not on the InfoWars page, too. So
that's where to read them.
Yeah. So why not? You know, why not do what we're supposed to be doing as opposed to having this TSA?
He's right.
Alexander saying, wait, are you saying that we shouldn't offer them our friendship?
Yeah, we emphasis on end in friendship.
Right. But, I mean, what this does is this just brings us back to the first question, right? What should we or what are we going to do about Iran? What would a President Obama do about Iran? What would a Mitt Romney do about Iran? What
well,
would a Newt
that's,
Gingrich,
that's
what would a Herman Cain?
I got that one cartoon again. I don't want to keep pushing, but it's called Iran. It has the last six presidents, and none of them did anything.
Mm-hmm.
241 Marines were blown up, murdered by Hezbollah, the proxy of Iran. Reagan did nothing. So who the hell is going to do it? I don't know.
I don't see any of them doing the proper thing here. You know, and Obama, like I said, whereas he has been surprisingly eager to do some things in the Middle East. I mean, I was sort of surprised that he got Osama bin Laden the way he did. Now, I guess that George W. Bush had set the procedures in place and that Obama was just letting those things be carried out. But the Libya thing was entirely Obama's, right? Now, of course, it made things worse there. So that's the thing. He got involved. He unseated Gaddafi. And what
it's
we have is clearly worse.
It's as if he wants to make the world safer for Islam, safer for Sharia law, as if that's his goal. Egypt, Libya, Tunisia.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm not as experienced a political talk show host enough to get all arrogant and say, okay, I'm going to predict and I'm going to tell you. But my gut is that he doesn't want to unseat the leadership in Iran because Iran is the one country in which the opposition might actually be in favor of true freedom of some kind.
It's possible. And again, that candlelight vigil for 9/11 is damn telling.
Yeah.
It is.
Now, that's one possibility. The other possibility is that the fact that, you know, the trend that we saw here in the United States, and here we're going to integrate with something else that we talked about today, the rising anti-Semitism in our country.
Right.
If anti-Semitism is rising in our country, then it might also be rising in Iran.
Oh, yeah.
And
I mean,
so
it's already, you know, locked in there.
Well, there's a lot of it there, but whereas we would talk about, and I think, didn't Colin Powell receive appeals from the student sort of democracy movement in Iran?
Maybe, but also Colin Powell wanted to work with Iran against terrorism after 9/11. This is the same Colin Powell, so who knows if he says everything is true. But also one thing about anti-Semitism, being raised Muslim, the average Muslim, there's anti-Semitism across, I mean, it's very casual, it is admiration for Hitler.
Yeah.
I'm working on a project, you know, because I refer to Hitler as Islam's favorite infidel. I'm working on a project for that, but anti-Semitism is bred within, I mean, it's part of the fiber of Islam and part of being raised, even for the most moderate. So I don't know how much worse it can get in the Middle East, I mean, is what I'm saying. Anti-Semitism.
Yeah. Now,
it's already part of them.
You know, he might go after them if it's he sees it as a way for him to get elected.
Sure, if it's right? Politically.
Yeah, he might get reelected if he does that. Yeah, I'll remember.
Okay.
He's telling me we got to mention some stuff before we close.
The time's gone.
I know, our time is gone. So he might, if it means he gets reelected. My gut is that he's very hesitant to do it, and only if he's forced into it is he going to do it. I was surprised to read that Guardian UK story saying that we might be close to doing something militarily about Iran. But I might be proved wrong. We'll see how it goes. I'd like to remind you during the week to go ahead and come to my blog at don'tletitgo.com. As I said, you can find a link to the brief that we talked about today, the amicus brief in the Obamacare litigation, is there on the post for today's page. I've also got links there where you can follow me on Twitter. You can go to the Facebook page, Don't Let It Go Unheard. There's all the links there at my blog. This week, I've got an article coming out. I did write a very nice review of the Steve Jobs bio that's got a unique angle to it, and I'm waiting for it to be published. It's been done for a couple days now. As soon as it's out, I will be tweeting it and all those sorts of things. Bosch is also still working frantically on an article. At my blog, I do have a cute emoticon thing that he helped me with this week, so you can check that out as well.
What's the title of your piece?
It's called iBio, Why Steve Jobs Getting the Biography Done is His Final Stroke of Genius. Have a good day, everyone. Take care.
Take care.